You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording in Washington, D.C.
And I am your co-host, Catherine Butts, and I am also recording in Washington, D.C.
Hey, Katie, welcome to 2025. Happy New Year. Hope the year is treating you well so far.
Yeah, nice and cold.
That's right. And I hope our listeners are having a good start to the new year as well, wherever they might be. It's pretty remarkable to think that we're coming up on the 11th year now of the Asia Geopolitics podcast. And I guess for those of us here in the United States, that means that this podcast is now going to be going into its fourth presidential term, essentially, because President Biden is wrapping up in office in the next few days. Katie and I are having this conversation on January 10th, so just 10 more days left in office for Biden. But we thought this would be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about the Biden administration's 4 years in office and what that's meant really in Asia on trade, on security, on broader economic relations, and the regional order writ large. Obviously, that's a lot to put on the table, but we'll try to be somewhat focused. Katie, I think maybe we could go a little bit chronologically. So, you know, taking listeners all the way back to 2021, I think one of the major interventions by the Biden administration that year, or rather unanticipated interventions, was the sudden withdrawal from Afghanistan in August that year, which has had reverberations in Afghanistan, of course, with the return of the Taliban, but more broadly in the region. From where you're sitting, you know, given that you think quite a bit about Central Asia and Afghanistan, how do you think that legacy will be remembered going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Afghanistan legacy is one that is too complicated and too messy to ascribe to one president. I think we have to keep in mind that the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan stretched for 20 years. There were several presidents involved in Afghanistan from both political parties in the United States. I think, as always is the case, the sort of last person in the room is the one left with the responsibility. So this isn't to say that the Biden administration holds no responsibility for the outcomes of the war in Afghanistan, how it ended. But I do think it is also worth remembering that the Biden administration was handed an exit plan that they did not negotiate. Originally, the final sort of deal between the United States and the Taliban was that the U.S. would leave Afghanistan by May 1. And one of the first things Biden decided sort of by April of 2021, we knew that they were going to delay the withdrawal until September 1. Whether that mattered or not, you know, we never get to know the alternate history. But there, I think there was just this unease. There was this plan that had been enacted. And I think this is one of the challenges every president faces, is that even if they have different political leanings to their predecessors, they're still handed a whole government machine that is working on something. And it is very hard to change course. I think ultimately, however, the Biden administration will hold a lot of the responsibility, in particular for how things happened in August. And I think some of Biden's comments in those days, which really laid a lot of blame is probably the word, on the Afghan administration. And again, this isn't to say that they don't hold some of the responsibility for what ultimately happened. The rapid collapse of the Ghani government is something I think Afghans also have to deal with. But the United States has sort of, it is impossible to extricate the United States from this. And I think that will be complicated. There are several sort of efforts underway in the United States to look back and figure out what happened. And I think it'll be important to pay attention to where those go in the future, in particular under new administration, which I think will have would like the Biden administration to be left with that bag, but also will inherit. There's still continued efforts to get people out of Afghanistan. There's still continued efforts to resettle people in the United States and in other countries who aided the United States and NATO. And so I think this is not an issue that's going to go away.
That's right. Yeah, I guess it's a little unfair to try to distill all of these complex legacies into just a couple minutes, but I think that was a really good overview of the picture with Afghanistan in particular. I guess, you know, moving ahead chronologically a little bit, I mean, this one isn't really an Asia legacy per se, but it certainly has global ramifications, which is the way in which the Biden administration handled the Russian invasion of Ukraine, both the lead up to that invasion in the final months of 2021, where the administration, of course, practiced strategic declassification with allies and partners attempting to convince them of what the United States believed was a pretty reliable set of indicators that Russia was serious about invading Ukraine. And of course, that was proven right in February 2022, leading to a broad-based U.S. Diplomatic campaign around the world to isolate Russia. And I think in Asia, that that broader part of rallying world opinion and getting countries on board to isolate Russia, I think had mixed results. I mean, you know, great success with allies in the region, arguably. You had certain partner countries like Singapore coming on board as well, but a bit of a mixed bag with other countries, right? Like India, for instance, obviously, and then attempting to get some of the less aligned countries in Asia to also isolate Russia was, I think, a little bit more challenging. But, you know, I mean, obviously the chapter has not yet closed on the Ukraine conflict, but I think what's going to be interesting, and this is perhaps why it's difficult to talk about this in January, is that we're going to see a very different approach with the new administration in Washington. And I think that approach, including what that might mean for a potential settlement of that war with its broader global ramifications, is going to, I think, shape the Biden legacy on this, right? And one of the interesting things for me, of course, is the legacy of the administration on managing escalation between NATO and Russia throughout this conflict. I think, you know, we now know that October 2022 was a dangerous time where, according to some reporting, the U.S. intelligence community believed there was as great as a coin flips of a chance that Russia might have used a nuclear weapon or multiple nuclear weapons against Ukraine. And it was interesting that the U.S. was actually somewhat successful in at least playing something of a role in getting China and India to apply certain pressure on Russia, indicating that that was a line that should not be crossed. Anything else jump out to you on the Ukraine front here? I mean, I think we've talked about this on the podcast repeatedly, but I think it's particularly, I think, an interesting kind of inflection point that we're at now heading into the new administration.
Yeah, certainly. And I think maybe an adjacent issue to kind of move us forward, you know, is the Ukraine kerfuffle, if I could use that word, makes us, I think about alliances also and sort of those connections. But before we move into sort of what I'd like to talk about, which is sort of the alliance structures and some of those mini laterals the Biden administration certainly put a lot of stake in the last 4 years, is the idea, the sort of amorphous idea that always comes up, that the United States always continues to get distracted from Asia, by the Middle East, by Europe. I think Ukraine was this interesting sort of point at which it really became kind of a global issue. I'm sure there are regions of the world that maybe are not interested in Ukraine, but for our purposes here, Asia was very interested in what was happening. When you look at sort of the responses in Taiwan and in Japan in particular, I think had a really interesting response, and sort of the Northeast Asia region, I think, was watching that conflict and thinking about itself in interesting ways and thinking about China in interesting ways. And so, you know, while we do divide the world into these regions, I think Ukraine was that reminder that, you know, these regions are constructs, and that what happens in one part of the world does impact other parts of the world, certainly in how people think about things like conflict and about alliances. And so moving back to that alliance question, I wanted to ask you, you know, Ankit, what your thoughts on sort of the Biden administration's efforts to strengthen U.S. alliance structures in Asia. We have, you know, the Quad was resurrected under the Trump administration, but I think really hit its stride under the Biden administration, particularly after the pandemic. The AUKUS agreement and that, all of that comes from that, the Japan, South Korea, U.S. trilateral, some of those things. So, you know, how in particular Northeast Asia is sort of the locus of U.S. alliances in Asia, but how do you reflect on that?
Yeah, so, you know, this takes us all the way back to Biden's inaugural address in 2021, where he pretty openly tells the world that, you know, the United States is back and allies will be back at the center. And in a way, I think that resulted in an administration that perhaps at times put a little bit too much of a premium on kind of making the allies happy, right? And, you know, we could maybe get into that a little bit more. I mean, it was really You could even call it a bit of an apology tour for the first Trump term and the way in which allies had been treated. But certainly it wasn't simply an attempt to get alliances back to where they were in 2016. There was, as you noted, new kind of contributions on certainly the Australia front with AUKUS, which was a huge and risky undertaking in 2021. Obviously, it's a multi-decade initiative, so far too early to even talk about, mm-hmm. you know, anything coming close to a legacy of AUKUS. I think the big anxiety now is, you know, will AUKUS persist in the way that it has mm-hmm. been? You know, will Donald Trump come in and start asking the Australians to pay substantially more for various types of technology transfer, despite the fact that Australia is putting in billions of dollars into the U.S. Submarine industrial base and other parts of the U.S. defense mm-hmm. Defense industrial base. In Northeast Asia, I think there's a pretty interesting legacy as well. The alliance with South Korea took a really interesting turn with the Washington Declaration in April 2023 and the announcement of new mechanisms to reassure the country. As, of course, we've discussed on this podcast, there's growing interest in South Korea in nuclear weapons of their own. And the Biden administration, I think, took that head on with new measures to reassure the country. But of course, I think while we're talking about South Korea, you know, we just talked about the martial law crisis in December 2024. And I think that's a really good reminder that alliance management is not something that can occur independent of domestic political dynamics in those countries. And so mm-hmm. now I think with South Korean conservatives pretty much significantly kneecapped domestically, it is going to be interesting to see whether some of that, some of what was accomplished with the Yoon administration will have persistence. I mean, will the institutionalization of those new mechanisms actually persist? Big questions in Washington about that, big questions in Seoul about that going forward. So again, perhaps a little too early to talk about legacy, but the Biden administration certainly did try to take things forward on that front. And then you talked about trilateralism. The Camp David Accord, you know, it's interesting because just 10 days from now, none of the three leaders that were at Camp David for that historic trilateral summit are going to be in office anymore, right? And so you have a new constellation of leadership. And this is really the problem, I think, for trilateralism in Northeast Asia for the United States. It's been very much subject to these domestic political changes, to leaders that are willing to take risks, right? In this case, in Korea, Yoon, who, you know, as I think we talked about on the martial law podcast, you know, who was not a typical politician, was very much willing to take risks with Japan. Of course, his risk taking also manifested arguably in his decision to declare martial law. But now I think, you know, going forward, I have significant questions about trilateralism. I mean, if there's anything we know about Donald Trump, it's that he thinks in bilateral terms, right, with pretty mm-hmm. much every country. And so it will be interesting to see if that will persist. And then the Quad, I mean, you know, I think you're right about the Quad. The one observation I would make, though, is compared to the first Trump term, you know, the Biden administration pretty overtly undertook, I think, an effort to desecuritize the Quad, right? They stopped calling it a quadrilateral security dialogue. They introduced numerous working groups within the Quad on kind of climate, space, you know, governance, supply chains, all these other issues that are very much delinked from anything that might evoke, as China loves to say, an Asian NATO. Mm-hmm. Which I think is interesting. And going forward, it'll be interesting to see if that DNA in the Quad will persist or if we're going to return to something more of an overt securitization. On that front, Katie, maybe let's move on a bit to, I think, where Biden perhaps has the most, perhaps, difficult legacy in Asia, which is on the economic statecraft side, which mm-hmm. I think is just worth talking about briefly. We don't have to get too deep into it. But obviously, I think American allies and partners, despite the great demand in the region for trade liberalization and integration and market access, have recognized that there is no political constituency in the United States post-Obama, essentially, for mm-hmm. trade liberalization. And so the Biden administration, of course, didn't return to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but instead propounded the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which I think has a very kind of modest record, which I think was pretty obvious at the time that it was announced, that it was essentially a consolation prize for Asia. How do you sort of, you know, having looked at this for a while now, including, of course, I think several pieces that have been published at The Diplomat on this legacy, what's the takeaway here? I mean, is this really the end of the United States seeking broader economic leadership in Asia and greater integration?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if it's the end of the United States seeing that sort of trade liberalization. It certainly is the end for now. I don't see that becoming a priority for the Trump administration. And you said it earlier that, you know, I think we sometimes would like to discount the power of domestic politics in shaping what countries choose to pursue in their foreign policies when that's, you know, it is absolutely vital. You know, the choices that countries make internationally are based on what they perceive their interests to be, and those are very much domestic. Those are always going to be domestic. And so, you know, because as you said, you know, there isn't that constituency in the United States for trade liberalization, because what it would mean economically for certainly some segments of the U.S. population, you know, I just don't see the appetite for it. Even if, you know, as sort of foreign policy wonks, we look at paper and we look at the numbers and we go, this would make so much sense. But, you know, I don't think the time is now. You know, that time has passed for now. But I think another sort of key lesson in foreign policy is that, you know, time is a flat circle. It will come right back around at some point, maybe. We'll see what happens. I just don't foresee it happening under the Trump administration.
Yeah. Well, the other thing on the trade legacy is, with Japan, I think it's worth noting the recent decision by Biden to quash the acquisition of Nippon Steel, right? I think that sends a pretty strong signal. I think it's resulted in a bit of frustration in Tokyo, obviously, because the national security rationale that was cited for preventing the acquisition, I think, is not one that's seen as particularly credible in Tokyo, right? Japan is an ally, and this is the foreign investment. The CFIUS process is presumably not designed to block these types of acquisitions, and so the argument again, comes back to domestic politics, to Biden's fealty to American unions, for instance. And I think there's also something to be said that the fact that U.S. Steel is called U.S. Steel, the symbolism there is pretty stark. So, anyways, let's keep going. A lot more to talk about. I think maybe we can pivot a little bit to Southeast Asia, where, I think it's fair to say that I was expecting over these last 4 years to see more engagement with Southeast Asia than we ended up seeing under the Biden administration, down to, I think, the president's own willingness to travel to the region. Probably the most positive thing that can be said is with regards to the Philippines, right? We didn't talk about the Philippines in the alliance discussion, but the expansion of the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Act, partly also aided by the fact that there's a leader in the Philippines now in the form of Marcos Jr., who is very pro the alliance with the United States and very much interested in bolstering the Philippines' own deterrence capabilities vis-a-vis China in the region. But apart from that, I think Southeast Asia has been, in a way, caught between the United States and China, as we've talked about for years, frankly, on this podcast. And I don't think the Biden administration really took the initiative to essentially provide a case for why the United States is going to ultimately be a better proposition for many of those countries that want to benefit equally from the U.S. and China on particularly the economic side, right? So I think there's a close link between what we just talked about on economic demand signals in the region and the legacy in Southeast Asia. Any other observations? I mean, I know we're kind of going through this at a breakneck speed, and there's a lot more to dig into, but any other observations that jump out on the SEA front?
Yeah, no, not particularly. I mean, I think the strength of development in the U.S.-Philippines relationship sort of proves the point that engagement with the rest of Southeast Asia was fairly lagging. And you know, if it was there, maybe the Biden administration just didn't want to push Southeast Asia. And Southeast Asia, as you noted, is sort of caught in between the United States and China in that regard. So, you know, maybe some of that quieter diplomacy will yield fruit someday. But I, you know, I think Southeast Asia focused folks will know that that engagement just wasn't really there in a big way.
So, the next thing I think to talk about is probably the adversaries, right? So, North Korea, where there's really not a lot to say because there was no diplomacy. There was no engagement between the United States and North Korea during the Biden administration's term. I doubt that's going to change in the 10 days before Biden leaves office. And then China, where I think you've certainly had a bit of a roller coaster ride from essentially, the initial virtual meetings between Biden and Xi going reasonably well to the spy balloon crisis to
Balloon.
tightening economic warfare, decoupling, de-risking, and then finally, as we talked about recently, the fairly upward swing in November 2024 with the U.S. and China, for instance, agreeing to language on artificial intelligence in sort of decision making over nuclear weapons. China notifying the United States of a missile test into the Pacific in earlier in 2024 as well. But really, I think the trend line represents broader continuity, right? Where you have strategic competition with a difference in tone, the emphasis on responsible competition by the Biden administration, all the talk of guardrails and trying to ensure that U.S.-China crisis communications mechanisms could resume. But broadly, the U.S. and China do remain on a trajectory of broader confrontation. And I think that has been pretty clear, and it will likely persist. It will be, I think, interesting to see when we look back on the Biden years vis-a-vis the relationship with China, how much the efforts at convincing the rest of the region that economic de-risking or decoupling was essential, how successful that will be going forward, particularly given that we are now looking at another trade war and essentially open economic warfare between the U.S. and China, potentially under a Trump administration. What else jumps out to you on the China legacy?
I think you sort of you said it well when you said, the trend line is really continuity, and the only really changes we could kind of dicker over are in terms of tone. But again, because the interests of both parties haven't really changed, and the competition in the core of that contest hasn't really changed. I think it's interesting, if you look earlier in the Biden administration, the democracy push and sort of how that contrasts with China's great civilization initiatives, which are kind of part of this successor's the wrong word, but continuation of the Belt and Road sort of idea, and kind of linking these countries together in something greater than just infrastructure. And I think those sort of civilizational kind of challenges continue to sort of will continue to define that relationship. What is going to change is going to be the tone, and maybe how far certain administrations will be willing to go, and where that heads. But I think I don't, I think Biden administration probably did as much as they could, but China also has its own domestic constituencies to deal with, just in different ways.
Well, Katie, I think we'll leave it there. And apologies to listeners who maybe did not get to hear us address the legacy of the Biden administration on the particular country or issue that they're interested in. But there will be a lot more to say, I think, going forward. We didn't really get to talk about India, for instance, where I do think there is quite a bit to say. But we've got a lot more to talk about, and we'll be back soon in the coming weeks with the next episode being the first one of the second Trump term in Asia. So as always, if you have suggestions for us, do reach out to either of us on social media or by email, and we're very happy to take that into consideration. In the meantime, if you are not a subscriber yet to the show, make sure you do subscribe. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. We really do appreciate that. Helps the show out a lot. And if you have subscribed for a while, but you haven't yet left us a review, please do that. That also helps the show out quite a bit. In the meantime, Katie, thanks for joining me, and looking forward to being back with you soon to talk about more in Asia.
Absolutely. And I do want to make one little PS for our listeners. Please check out the January issue of the Diplomats Magazine, which is our What to Expect issue. We do this every January. It essentially lays out all of the regions, including the ones we didn't get to talk about much today, and what our authors think you should be paying attention to in those regions, different trends, different individuals, different upcoming events. So please check that out if you want to know what's going to happen this year, or as best as we can. It's not a prediction, but we certainly are thinking about 2025 as deeply as we can. Thanks for listening.